It is very good to see everybody here this evening. Do appreciate your attention. You remember this morning we talked about the idea of irrelevance in our society. And I'd like to go ahead and, in a sense, do a part two to that lesson, where this morning we talked about the idea of seeking relevance and how it is in following Christ that we actually find incredible cultural irrelevance, that we follow Jesus out of the gate, as Hebrews chapter 13, verse 13 says, we join him outside the city on the outskirts. As he is an outcast, so we shall be outcasts with him, and we shall bear his reproach proudly. We wear the name Christian, and we are not afraid to proclaim it. So with all that being said this morning, what I want to do this evening is look at a practical application. If we are to become irrelevant to society, and by that I mean our vote doesn't matter and people don't care what we think and what the Christian says is not necessarily what goes in society when it comes to morals and ethics, really, what are we supposed to do when we face a time, and the time may come someday, when our government no longer stands for righteousness at all? How can we, as followers of Jesus Christ and members of his kingdom, submit ourselves to a government that does not stand up for the things that we stand up for? So in our lesson tonight, we'll discuss the idea of civil disobedience. And we will begin in Romans chapter 13. Please turn with me, if you will, to Romans chapter 13. And I'd like to read verses 1 through 7. Probably the most fundamental text from the New Testament that we could go to talk about the Christian's role in government and the Christian's role in submitting to civil authorities. In Romans chapter 13, notice beginning in verse 1, let every person be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, he who resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed, will receive condemnation upon themselves. Verse 3, for rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath upon those who practice evil. Wherefore it is necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for your conscience' sake. Now he goes on to say here in verse 6, for because of this you also pay taxes, for rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due them, tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom is due, fear to whom fear is due, and honor to whom honor is due. Now, while the above passage is probably the most expansive scripture on the Christian's relationship to civil authority, it's not the only one. Go to 1 Peter chapter 2 and notice beginning in verse 13. 1 Peter chapter 2 and in verse 13. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. For such is the will of God, that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. Now, even with all of that being said, with these scriptures that are acknowledging our submission, commanding, really, our submission to civil authorities, there's a couple of things that we need to remember. Some things that maybe give us a qualifier when it comes to our obedience to government. The first is this: God might have ordained government, but he never ordained its evil practices. I think we have to acknowledge this idea that God ordained government, but not its evil practices. God is always opposed to evil, corruption, greed, and cruelty. And all of those things go hand in hand with human government at times. God acknowledges this in Deuteronomy chapter 17, in a great passage that predicts that one day the Israelites would have a king ruling over them. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, beginning in verse 14, he says, as a word of warning to that future king and line of kings, watch out for corruption. Watch out for the pursuit of wealth. Watch out for the pursuit of lust. watch out for the things that trip men up. And one thing that he asks those future kings of Israel to do is to know the law. That when they are made king, they're to write down a copy of the law for themselves. There's no indication anywhere in the Bible that God approves of the evil activities of any government. In fact, the thrust of many passages, especially the prophets, Amos, Jonah, and Nahum come to my mind, for example, is that it is the believer's responsibility to do what he can within the laws of the land to change his government, if his government is in fact evil. Isaiah 10 and verse 1 says, "Woe to those who make unjust laws and to those who issue oppressive decrees." So God might have appointed authorities in this land. He might have appointed authorities in every land. He might have been behind the appointment of all civil governments for all time, but that doesn't mean he endorses their evil practices. In Ecclesiastes chapter 5, notice what the writer says here in Ecclesiastes 5, verses 8 and 9, a passage that at first seems a little bit confusing, but I think has a great point behind it. He says in Ecclesiastes 5, beginning in verse 8, "If you see oppression of the poor and denial of justice and righteousness in the province, don't be shocked at the sight." I think that's a really good thing to remember. If you find out that your government is corrupt, don't act surprised by it. Don't be shocked. Really? People take bribes in our government? You mean there's ulterior motives? You mean they actually listen to the lobbyists? What? Don't act shocked when you find out that there's denial of justice and oppression and cruelty in our government. Now he goes on to say, one official watches over another, and another official watches over another, and there are higher officials over them. So what he's basically saying is, when it comes to government, everybody wants to get a little piece of the pie. Everybody wants to put their hand in the pot, you know? And for every government official who takes a little off the top, there's somebody over him who wants his little cut also. Don't be shocked by that. People are going to be people, whether they're government officials or not. But he does say in verse 9, here's kind of the qualifier here in verse 9 of Ecclesiastes 5. After all, a king who cultivates the field is an advantage to the land. Now, that's an odd verse, but most commentators believe that what he's saying there is, it's better to have a corrupt government than to have anarchy. That yes, if you're going to have a king, and yes, you're going to have government, there's going to be corruption. That is absolutely true. It comes with government. But he says a king is an advantage to the land because the king is able to provide a structure within people to within which people can work. A king is able to provide structure to the land. And it's better to have a king who can provide structure to a society so that fields are cultivated, so the land is productive, so that a country is actually working and producing and organized in some way. It's better to have a king who's corrupt than to have no king at all and have lands sit being underused. After all, a king is an advantage to the land because the king provides the structure within which people can work and be productive. Another thing to remember, a qualifier about our obedience to government, is that obedience to government is never unqualified when it comes to its place in relation to God. That yes, Romans 13 and 1 Peter 2 command us to be obedient and submit ourselves to a government. But that doesn't mean we obey government to the exclusion or the neglect of our obedience to God. That we are to obey God first and foremost, like in Acts chapter 4 and verse 19, where Peter says to the authorities over him, "Judge for yourselves whether it is right in God's sight to obey you rather than God." And of course, Peter and the other apostles go right on obeying God and proclaiming the gospel. We also do not ever need to obey its evils. In fact, we should never obey evil at all. God never commands us to submit to evil edicts from our governments. So with all that being said then, let's talk about the divinely approved instances of civil disobedience in the Bible. And there are more than you might realize. Let's talk about these for a moment. In Exodus chapter 1, you remember what the command was in Exodus chapter 1, that the Hebrews were overpopulating. They were taking over the land. And Pharaoh is concerned here in Exodus chapter 1 that if there are too many Hebrew slaves being born, that eventually they might overrun the land of Egypt and take over the place. So he commands the Hebrew midwives to kill all of the male Hebrew babies who are born. That is, for all practical purposes, a law that a civil authority put in place. Okay, so we have a case in point now. Okay, what are we supposed to do when a government enacts a law that instructs or commands us to commit evil and atrocious acts? Well, in Exodus chapter 1, as we know from the text, especially in verse 17, that these individuals, the midwives, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do, so that they let the boys live. And as a result of this, the text does go on to say that God took care of them and was very, very kind to the Hebrew midwives. So kind of keep that one logged away in the back of your mind. Another example here. Go a little bit further in the book of Exodus, in particular Exodus 5 through chapter 12, and the entire interaction between Pharaoh and Moses. Moses requests in Exodus chapter 5, "Let my people go so that we may hold a festival to the Lord in the desert." And what's Pharaoh's response? He says in verse 2 of Exodus 5, "Who is the Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go." Again, that's an edict from a civil authority. The civil authority said, "I've made a decision. It's my decision to make. I'm the ruler of this land. You are not leaving Egypt." And until chapter 12, Moses spends all of his time and energy doing everything he can to get Israel to leave Egypt. In 1 Kings chapter 18, wicked King Jezebel was in the process of trying to kill off the Lord's prophets. And in defiance of those orders to kill all the prophets of the Lord in the land, one prophet named Obadiah, in 1 Kings chapter 18 and verse 4, it says, had taken 100 prophets and hidden them in 2 caves, and had supplied them with food and water. Now, even though nowhere in the text God specifically or explicitly approves of the situation, I don't think any of us would disagree with the assertion that God approved of a man rescuing 100 prophets of the Lord, hiding them in a cave, and taking care of them during that time period. I don't think any of us would disagree that that is a good thing and that Obadiah was right for doing it. We move on to the book of Daniel now. In Daniel chapter 3 and verse 5, an order was given, and all the people were commanded to bow before an image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. But 3 Hebrew men defiantly responded in verse 18 of Daniel chapter 3, "We want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold that you have set up." And of course, as a result of this, God rescues them and blesses them immensely. We know that God approved of that particular case of civil disobedience. A truly classic case happens in Daniel chapter 6, in which the prophet Daniel, who is himself a servant of the government, refused to obey an order that anyone, according to verse 7, anyone who prayed to any god or man during the next 30 days shall be thrown into the lion's den. And in defiance of that order, according to verse 10, he prayed 3 times a day, just as he had always done. That was an order from the civil authorities that he directly disobeyed. In Acts chapter 4, as we've already alluded to, Peter defies civil authority when they commanded him to stop proclaiming the gospel. And we know from Revelation chapters 12 through 13 that the images there from that symbolic book illustrate Christians disobeying civil authority. So with all of that now kind of in the back of our minds and these examples that we've considered, let's go to Revelation chapter 14 and notice what is said here, I believe, in a conclusion to this. Go to Revelation chapter 14 and verse 4. It said that these are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been purchased from among men as first fruits to God and to the Lamb. When you read in Revelation 12 and 13 in the beginning of chapter 14, what you find is these images that are set up. And of course, we don't have time to really get deep into those images, but these images that are set up of God's people existing on planet Earth under the rule of a Roman government that is, in every sense of the word, evil and ungodly. And this Roman government sets up state religion and commands them to worship the state religion and has powers that are put in place that make sure that that command is followed by all of the people. It was expected of you, commanded of you, to partake in the state religion, to essentially worship Caesar and the Roman government and its power and what it symbolized. Now, they did not worship the Roman government. They did not worship Caesar. And there were a few of them out of Rome who survived. And that's what Revelation 14, verse 4 is describing. There's a right way and a wrong way, then, to disobey civil authority. And I think all of these examples that we've looked at give us a pattern to follow. If you look at all of the divinely approved examples of disobedience to civil authority in the Bible, they illustrate the same basic concepts. And I want to look at those for just a few minutes here. First of all, I'm going to give you some very long words. They're really fun words to say if you can figure out how to say them. Anti-promulgation versus anti-compulsion. And I believe all of the examples of divinely approved civil disobedience illustrate this concept. First of all, anti-promulgation is the idea of disobeying civil government when government permits evil or allows evil to happen. That's the idea. Anti-promulgation means that if a government promulgates, which is promoting or decrees something that's evil and allows it to happen, then I'm going to disobey government. Anti-compulsion is the idea of disobeying government only when government commands you to do evil. Do you see the difference there? There's a huge difference between a government that says you may divorce for any reason whatsoever and a government that commands you to get divorced. There's a big difference between a government that allows you legally to use marijuana versus a government that commands you to use marijuana. You see the difference there then. So on one side of it then, somebody would argue, well, I'll disobey civil authority when it allows evil things to happen versus I'll disobey civil authority only when it tries to force me to do those evil things. Again, when you look at all of the examples that we illustrated from the Bible, Daniel in particular, Daniel never argued against the commandment, but he did argue against what it told him to do. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did not argue against the golden image per se. And if other people wanted to worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar set up, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego never try to stop them from worshiping the golden image. But when a command comes that says, no, you must worship the golden image, or Daniel, you must not pray to your God, it was at that point that those Hebrew men in Babylon disobeyed civil authority. Anti-promulgation says that I will disobey when it announces evil laws versus I will disobey when it compels evil action by law. Anti-promulgation says I'll disobey when it limits my freedom in some way, whereas anti-compulsion says I'll disobey when it negates my freedom altogether. What I mean by that is, and I think there's some examples that maybe we could think of, where government, on the one hand, that owns property, might be able to say, you are not allowed to preach the gospel on government-owned property. I think most of us would accept that, because the government hasn't come in any way to stop me from preaching. It has simply tried to limit my freedom in some way. I can still preach the gospel, just not on government property. But there's a huge difference between government saying you may not preach the gospel on government property versus you may not preach the gospel at all. And that's, again, the difference between anti-promulgation and anti-compulsion. Anti-promulgation says I'll disobey when it is politically oppressive to me Whereas anti-compulsion will say, I will disobey when it is religiously oppressive. And the reason why I bring all this up is I just want to illustrate again from these examples from the Bible that all of these Bible examples are promoting an anti-compulsion form of civil disobedience. These examples are not saying anti-promulgation, they're all saying anti-compulsion. When the government compels you by law to do evil, it is at that point that you disobey. But a government that allows evil to exist is not necessarily one that we are expected by God or allowed by God to disobey. So what else do we learn from these biblical examples? First of all, God's people refuse to obey an evil commandment, but in all of these examples, they do not revolt against authority in general. And I think that's an important point to remember. When Daniel or Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or Obadiah, or Moses, when they disobeyed civil authority, they were not trying to destroy civil authority. They were not trying to tear down civil authority. They were not trying to bring down authority in general. It was specific aspects of civil authority that they had a problem with. So God is not anywhere in the Bible promoting anarchism or the destruction of government or tearing down order in society. That's never anywhere in the Bible. Another point that I notice from these examples is that disobedience is non-violent. In Romans chapter 12, verses 17 through 21, Christians are commanded by God through the Apostle Paul never to take your own revenge. Why? Because God says, "Vengeance is mine." God will take care of evildoers in His own way, in His own time. And I think it's interesting that right after Romans chapter 12, what's the very next chapter? Romans 13. God tells individuals, never take your own revenge because God will take care of vengeance for you. And in the very next chapter, God introduces through the Apostle Paul the idea of civil authority being God's sword for enacting vengeance in the world. So when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Daniel, when all of these men practice civil disobedience, it is non-violent civil disobedience that they practice. Believers always calmly accept the punishment for their civil disobedience as well. If they did something wrong, if they actually broke a law, if it was right by the law for them to go to prison, they accepted it. They accepted it. You notice that when Daniel chose to pray to God three times a day and they came to take him to the lion's den, Daniel did not fight them. He didn't struggle. He didn't try to run away. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were the same way. They did not put up a fight. They disobeyed civil authority because they believed God's authority was higher. And if civil authorities were going to kill them, well, that was what it was. Sometimes it's just best to flee. Sometimes it's just best to flee. I think we forget about that sometimes. We're in our culture always so eager to put up our dukes, to put up a fight. We're always so eager to defend something. We're always so eager to fight and claw for every inch of land, so to speak. Sometimes it is just best to flee. Sometimes it's just best. When you're Israel and you're in Egypt, and Pharaoh has enslaved you as a people, and it is God's expectation for you to move on, sometimes it's best just to move on. It's best to get out of Egypt and go where God wants you to be. Sometimes it's just best to flee. And take advantage of peaceful, lawful means of overcoming oppression. I love Paul's example. Paul was a guy, and I don't think he was being slippery or anything, but Paul was a guy who knew his legal rights in Rome. And Paul was always real quick to point out what his legal rights were. He knew the system. He knew what the laws were. He knew what it meant to be a citizen of Rome. In Acts chapter 22, for example. Notice in Acts chapter 22 and beginning in verse 24. So the commander ordered him to be brought into the barracks, that's Paul, stating that he should be examined by scourging so that he might find out the reason why they were shouting against him that way. And when they stretched him out with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who was standing by, "Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and who is uncondemned?" I love that Paul knew what the law was. And Paul knew that there was a legal, peaceful way to get out of his situation. Not fighting, not struggling, not kicking and screaming, but he knew what the law was, and he was willing to use the law to his advantage. When the centurion heard this, he went to the commander and told him, saying, "What are you about to do? This man is a Roman citizen." And the commander came and said to him, "Tell me, are you a Roman?" And he said, "Yes." He was a Roman citizen. And he knew what his rights were. And I think we also have to know what the laws are. Those laws are put in place not just so that evildoers can take advantage of them, but so that Christians can also know what our place in society is. And there's a lot of laws. Yes, there's a lot of laws that allow evil people to do evil things. There's a lot of laws that allow evil people to get away with things that we would deem to be immoral and condemnable sins. But you know what? There's also a lot of laws that protect us. And let's not forget that. There's a lot of laws in this country that protect us as well. And we need to know what those laws were. Another good example, in Acts chapter 25, verses 8 through 12, Paul makes a legal appeal to Caesar in his case. He knew what the law was, he knew what provisions there were in the law, and he knew that the best thing, the right thing, and the thing that God had decreed by prophecy was to get himself to Rome and make an appeal to Caesar directly. But what about revolution? We got the 4th of July coming up, don't we? It's kind of a tough one, isn't it? We are basically going to be celebrating with fireworks and barbecues the Independence Day, the day that our founding fathers disobeyed civil authority. The day that our founding fathers disobeyed Romans chapter 13. The day that our founding fathers disobeyed 1 Peter chapter 2 and chose not to submit to the authorities over them, whether kings or governors as sent by kings. We're going to be celebrating Independence Day, which seems to me, based on everything we've talked about in the lesson so far, is not something that we ought to be celebrating. So what about revolution? What about revolution? I want to skip on down to a point here just for the sake of time. The Bible is always consistent in its disapproval of rebellion against authority. Proverbs 24, verse 21 plainly states, "Fear the Lord and the king, my son, and do not join with the rebellious." Obey the king. Don't join in a rebellion. So what about our own American Revolution? I like the way one writer put it. Norman Geisler, in a book called Christian Ethics, I think summed it up really, really well. And by the way, I believe what he says here is a rational and logical way for us to both celebrate Independence Day without necessarily condoning the way that it came to us. Notice what Norman Geisler says in the book called Christian Ethics. "It's understandable that everyone would like to believe that the revolution in this country was just, even if those in other countries are not. But in all honesty, given the biblical criteria, it's just not possible. What then should American Christians do on the 4th of July? Can they really celebrate independence from Britain? In response, a distinction should be made." I really like the way he puts this here. "There is a difference between what is born and how it is born. An American Christian can celebrate what was born from the American Revolution, which is a great free country, without thereby approving of the way that it arrived." And perhaps an analogy might be helpful. And I'll try to keep the details to a minimum because I know young kids are in here and they don't necessarily need to know the dirty, horrible things of life. But let's say you were raped and a child was conceived because of that situation. And that baby was born. And that baby was the light of your life and the apple of your eye. And you loved that child every single day of your life. You loved that child dearly. And every single year, you celebrate that child's birthday. Now, did you approve of the way that that child was conceived? Of course not. Nobody approves of that. Nobody approves of that situation. And yet, can you take comfort and joy in what was produced out of a situation that you do not necessarily approve of? To me, I think that's a good analogy for thinking of this. As we understand it from the Bible, I don't think that it would be right for us Christians today to participate in a rebellion against civil authority? And yet, can we look at what was born out of the American Revolution? Can we look at that and say, the result of that, even though we might not have been able to participate by conscience in that activity, can we look at what was born from it and see that God does work in ways that we don't always understand, that God works through rebellion, that God works through anarchy, that God works through the overthrow of governments, that God even works through evil dictators like the Roman Caesars in the first century? That God's power is over all human authority. And can we look at what was born out of the American Revolution and feel extreme gratitude for that? I am grateful for this country. I am incredibly grateful for the freedoms and the liberties that we enjoy, even though I do not believe, based on what the Bible says, of submission to civil authority, that we ought to participate in a rebellion ourselves today. I appreciate the condition in which I live now. And I think today, in our situation, we need to take full advantage of what is before us, which is our freedom to worship and our freedom to proclaim the gospel. Remember something. In the first century, Rome was not America. Rome did not have a Bill of Rights. Rome did not have extensive freedoms that were extended to all of its citizens. Roman citizens didn't vote. There was no suffrage. People were owned as slaves, and the Caesars did whatever they wanted. And yet it was under that civil authority, an incredibly inferior civil authority to our own government. It was under that civil authority that Paul says in Romans 13, and Peter says in 1 Peter 2, to submit and to obey. Now that might be a tough lesson for us to follow. It might be a difficult thing for us to grasp, and that might not always be easy. When you couple tonight's lesson with this morning's lesson, the idea of feeling irrelevant in our culture, that who I vote for doesn't end up getting into office. The laws that I vote for, the right, the moral thing, doesn't end up becoming put into law. It might be very hard for us to accept our place in a society that wants us on the outskirts, that wants us alienated, a society that wants us marginalized. But based on the New Testament and other passages, I believe it is still a civil authority that God has enacted. And we should submit to that authority as long as we can submit in a way that I believe is consistent with all of the examples and the lessons that we looked at in our sermon tonight. Now, if you're not a Christian here this evening, I want to encourage you to think about something. You have citizenship in this country, in this world, in this life, for a very short time. You get to be an American citizen for just this life. But God promises you, through Jesus Christ, a citizenship in a place that is so far beyond this realm, so much more beautiful, so much more unimaginable. A land where Jesus is the light, where He is the sun, where there is a river of life that flows. Trees grow on either side that keep life sustained there for all eternity. A place where there is a sea of crystal-like glass, and at the center of it all is the Almighty One sitting upon a throne. We shall worship Him for all eternity. We shall share fellowship with all the saints. And God offers you citizenship in that country right now. This is a great country, but it's temporary. And it sure is small compared to the country that we really want to live in. Stop making excuses. Stop denying the gospel message and listen to what Jesus says. In Mark 16, verse 16, he who believes and is baptized shall be saved, but he who does not believe shall be condemned. So if you'd like to respond to the invitation, then I encourage you to please come forward as we stand and sing.